Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is Rewind, looking at this week in Wisconsin politics. J.R., I think two organizations that track campaign spending, you guys at WisPolitics, and also you do, Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and they released their totals this week. And we have to put it in context. The Republicans rewrote the campaign finance code. It hadn't been changed in a major way since, I think, the 1970s, post-Watergate.
Yep.
And they enacted all these major changes. They doubled the spending. Corporate can give. So I was intrigued by the Democracy Campaign numbers this week. First of all, they said spending just on seats for the legislature last year, $28.1 million, $9 million of it from outside groups. But that's an increase from the 2014, the last election, of 66%. So let's talk about the overall numbers.
I always tell people when they look at spending on races that as much as they put in to races, the donors, they must be getting something in return in terms of like who wins, benefits them a certain amount. So this is shows you kind of the investment these folks are making because they think there'll be a better return or a better financial situation for them going forward for their business, their personal life, whatever, because of who wins. So keep that in mind about the amount of money flowing.
I understand, but you still had a 66% increase. Is that a result of the
absolutely the
new campaign finance code doubling what everybody can give?
Here's a good example of what changed. Before, if you were a donor, you could give $10,000 a year to total between candidates for governor, assembly, political parties, everything. So while there was no cap on a donation, for example, to a political party, because that $10,000 per year cap, it acted as a limit for the parties because who wants to give to the party if you can give directly to a candidate? Well, that cap, that overall cap went away thanks to a court decision. So that we've had these Swiss, it's like Swiss cheese after a while, our campaign finance laws before this rewrite happened.
Yeah.
All these things went away. So now you have not only no limits for donations to parties or legislative campaign committees, but unlimited contribution or transfers from one to a candidate. So it's a much more attractive place to park your money. Robin Voss, Speaker of the Assembly, wanted that. His argument was by freeing up the parties and the campaign committees, you make them more attractive to put money there than an unregulated, shadowy special interest group. But what I will tell you is from looking at this and stuff we looked at, it didn't really dissuade the donations to the shadowy special interest groups. It did give the caucuses and the parties more control, quote unquote, over the message and the money in these races. But at the same time, the money, it gets expensive almost every time I cover an election.
And that's what that's where I want to go next. Let's talk about the four legislative campaign committees. The 2014, none of them, and remember, those are controlled by the four legislative leaders. In 2014, none of them raised more than $880,000. But when you look at what they raised last year, it's just amazing. A total of 5.63, and the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee doubled what it raised in 2014. It raised $1.66 million. Assembly Democratic Campaign Committee, 1.44, 2.5 times, 2014. State Senate Democratic Committee, 1.32 million, 4 times what it raised in 2014. And finally, Committee to Elect a Republican Senate, 1.21 million. Why almost tripling spending by the four legislative committees?
Well, you had two things. One, so we talked about the kind of the caps that were wiped out to kind of make it a more attractive place to park money. Two, they allowed corporate contributions for the first time directly to these caucuses. Now, the catch was you had to create this kind of extra committee to gather the money.
Yes.
One thing interesting, when I looked at this a few weeks ago, looking at the end of the year reports that came out in January for 16, this is the first time that I found that all four caucuses in the same year raised more than $1 million.
Yes.
Now, if
you're
you go back
right.
and look, like the Senate Democrats, I believe during the recalls, they eclipsed $1 million. But the first time all four in 1 year raised more than $1 million because there's more avenues to raise money. So that was one of the big takeaways I had from it.
Well, but 18 months ago, 24 months ago, former Democratic Senator Tim Tim Cullen predicted this. This is going to make the four legislative leaders dictators. Hmm. Because they're going to solicit money for the legislative campaign, and they're going to say they're going to give that money to those most like them, I believe, and they're going to punish those who they don't feel will toe the line if they're elected, right?
You're not suggesting politics come into play in deciding where money goes in campaigns.
Gambling? No. But you mentioned something I think is intriguing. I asked the Democracy Campaign. You talked about for the first time corporations could give. And let's just look at the top five givers, according to the Democracy Campaign. The Ho-Chunk donated, by the way, you could donate $12,000 to each of the four. Mm-hmm. The Ho-Chunk did that, $48,000. Yep. We Energy's $36,000. The Wisconsin Beer Distributors, $36,000. Homeowners Alliance, $35,500. So for the first time, corporations could give legally. Is this money that they had been giving through the back doors in other election cycles?
Good question. Now, one thing about these corporate accounts, is what I kind of call them, you couldn't use it for express advocacy. That's saying, like, I want Steve Walty elected to the state Senate, so I'm going to go ahead and give you money for or spend money on TV ads saying, elect Steve Walters. What the caucuses generally did, from my recollection of the reports, was spend on infrastructure, like staff salaries, you know, things like that that kind of are part of the foundation of the operations.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like they were buying TV ads with this stuff. But it gives you one more money to avenue to raise money and to pay for these infrastructure costs that they all have overhead. When you hire staff, when you have an office, you have costs, and they paid for those costs with this money.
Okay, now let's talk about the outside groups. They spent a total of $9 million. Again, all these numbers come from the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. But here's what intrigues me. Groups that back Democrats, $4.8 million. Groups backing Republicans, $4.2 million. Mm-hmm. Now, the traditional wisdom is that the Republican groups have deeper pockets. So are you surprised by the 4.8 groups helping Democrats, 4.2 helping Republicans?
No, because while we don't know for sure where it came from, we've had a suspicion in the Capitol for the last year that the road building industry was heavily involved this past election cycle for Democrats, Senate Democrats in particular, because they want to see revenue increases of the transportation fund. So when you look at the map, you're not going to have a chance to flip the assembly because they had such a big majority there going to the election. But the Senate was seen as there was a possibility. Now, this was before the Trump wave kind of happened and everything that we saw ended up. But back in summer of last year, in spring, we thought, okay, presidential year in Wisconsin should be increased Democratic turnout. Donald Trump looks like a train wreck. It's, you know, Hillary Clinton's got her problems, but, you know, we're a Democratic state in a presidential year. You should see at least a couple seats in play. If nothing else, Democrats could get to like maybe a one-seat minority, you know, get 17, 16, and be in a position to kind of muck things up. So the road builders, we can't prove just yet, said, okay, we're going to funnel money in and go after the 18th, Luther Olson the 14th, and play in some of these seats. Maybe Tom Tiffany, didn't end up happening, being a competitive race, but we'll spend money here and see if we can make some progress. Didn't happen yet.
Well, let's stay on the issue of outside spending a little bit. Did we see any major new players? Because according to the Democracy Campaign, Greater Wisconsin Committee was in for $2.1 million. Prosperity for Everyday People was in for $1
million. Is that a new group?
New group? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then on the other side, American Federation for Children, headed by Scott Jensen, $1 million, targeted in three or four specific races. Mm-hmm. And then WMC was $1.8 million. So did we see any major new groups and outside spenders?
Prosperity for Everyday People is new. I will say those numbers, some of them seem a little bit low because if you think about it, I'm not sure what all you can track because there is so much mail that goes out, so many small things. I mean, so many the campaigns have become so good at micro-targeting voters.
Yeah.
According to, for example, I'm sure they have lists of you, like what magazines you subscribe to, your profile. They develop these profiles of voters, people who turn out regularly, say, okay, we think, even though we're registered by a party in Wisconsin, we think you're going to be a Democrat because you subscribe to this and do this. We think Republican goes to that. They micro-target people. They know how to find people and get their message to them. So that's one maybe kind of expense that's not really reflected in this.
You don't think those expenses, those micro-targeting, show up on these reports?
Some of it's impossible to track. How would you know?
Okay, but still, the reports that are filed with the state and the feds, news
Express
organizations...
Express advocacy. Yep, we go through those all the time.
Right.
But the issue advocacy, if I get a mailer that says J.R. Ross is a bad person, call J.R. Ross...
Did you get
Ross
one yesterday slamming Tammy Baldwin? I did.
No, I did not.
Okay, go ahead.
But if you have those issue ads, they're not reported anywhere. You don't have to report that stuff. How big of a mailer... Things like that, you don't really know for sure.
Okay. Now let's look at First of all, six races cost more than $1 million in spending last year.
I remember I got here in 2000, and John Erpenbach in 98 had had the first million dollar race for state senate.
But it wasn't his campaign. You know, his campaign and his opponent, they spent like maybe a third to a half. Mm-hmm. The rest of it was independent spending. And you and I were told, I think it was 98, by Erpenbach, when that happens, that much independent spending, you lose complete control of your message and your campaign. You wake up in the morning not knowing what you're going to hear or read about yourself.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So now we have six legislative races. Last November cost more than $1 million. Mm-hmm. And the winner, drum roll, 18th Senate District, total spending of $5.1 million. Senator Fian spent $545,000. Democratic challenger, County Executive Mark Harris, 510. So they combined for one, special interest, 4 million. Yep. 4-1.
That was the race going in the Senate that we all knew had the best chance to be competitive, because if you go back to 2012, it was a 600 vote margin in that race. In 2008, it was a 300 some vote margin in that campaign. So Democrats won it in the recall election in 11 when Randy Hopper lost. So we knew this one had potential to go back and forth. In a gubernatorial year, off year, it's not that competitive. But in a presidential year, it gets much more competitive. And if Dem turnout was going to be up, we thought, okay, going to be a competitive race. In the end,
right?
I think Mr. Fine won with 50-some percent of the vote.
You looked it up before the show, 55.8%.
So it wasn't a good investment in the end. But part of this was the Trump effect that we saw, where, you know, people weren't happy about Hillary Clinton. Dems either stayed home, voted for somebody else, Republicans picked up new, whatever happened. This is an example of where we all thought this calculation was going to be, you know, a competitive race. In the end, it wasn't at all.
The job of being a Wisconsin legislator pays $50,900.
Mm-hmm.
5.1, or 100 times that, was spent on this race.
How big is the state budget? 70, how
75
many
billion? 75 all funds billion.
$1 billion.
Over 2 years.
A B, billion.
With a B. 100 times spent. Okay, let's talk about the second costliest race. Senate District 14, Luther Olson was challenged by a local mayor, Democrat Brian Smith. Total spending of $3 million. Mr. Smith and legislative campaign committees that supported him outspent Senator Olson, Mr. Smith, and campaigns $580,000. Senator Olson and Republican campaign committees $381,000. Outside spending of $2 million. Your take on that?
This one was an interesting study, because if you look at the seats that are really competitive in a presidential year in the state senate, on the numbers, that's really not one of them.
I mean, that's true.
It can be, like in an 08 or a 12 where you have big Dem turnout for Obama. It can be kind of competitive, but that is GOP territory. So that was a case where Democrats thought, and some Republicans thought, that Luther Olson was going to be in trouble because of the King Veterans Home issue and some other things. Okay, if there's a Trump drop-off, if there's Trump drag, which last spring we thought we're talking Trump drag and the potential for a wipeout for Republicans, that this would be an area where you would catch somebody possibly. If enough money was spent and Luther had enough problems, you could pick him off. In the end, it wasn't even kind of a close race, and it reflected its nature. And oh, by the way, what we saw across the country of white blue-collar voters voting for Republicans,
yes,
there's a great example right there of where they came home and then some.
Third legislative race in which the third most was spent, Assembly District 51, Dodgeville Mayor, Republican Representative Todd Novak, was challenged by which school district Mr. Wright worked for, do you remember?
Blank off the top of my head.
Okay, but anyway, the incumbent Todd Novak and GOP committees spent $510,000, Mr. Wright, $335,000. And let's see, you just looked that one up. This was a close one, 51%.
Yeah.
So this race?
That race, that seat is fascinating to me because it votes Democrat top of the ticket, often but Republican for the assembly level and the Senate level.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating seat. It's one of the southwestern Wisconsin, that corner, the three assembly seats that make up that Senate district that one's in, are three of the few ones I find that consistently vote differently, the bottom of the ticket versus the top. It's fascinating to watch.
It is. Now, let's quickly go through the other three races in which more than $1 million was spent. Jump in, JR, Senate District 12, Tom Tiffany and Brian Van Stuypen spent $1.1 million along with their legislative committees.
That one they tried to put away. The Republicans spent early and heavy in that race back in late summer, early fall to try and put away early, and they did a good job of doing that.
The candidates in the Ledge Committee spent $548,000. The rest of that spending, which totaled $1.1 million, came from outside groups. Senate 32, this was Senate Democratic Leader Schilling versus Dan Capanke, a rematch of that recall that took out Capanke.
Yep.
And what intrigues me, total spending in the 32nd of $1 million, the candidates and the ledge committees raised 75% of that, not so much outside spending.
Because that was a seat that we talked about to the very end of the race where Scott Fitzgerald said that's going to be a race, and nobody believed him. There was like, I think, one or two groups that went in and did small buys, but there wasn't a big like outcry of, you didn't see WMC and those folks going, okay, there's an opportunity to pick that up. They weren't really expecting that race to be competitive because normally it shouldn't be. But that was another one of those where you saw a phenomenon of white blue-collar voters who make up a huge part of that district either staying home for usually vote Democrats or going to Donald Trump, and then there being a little bit of a coattail effect.
Part of the 3rd Congressional District, which went heavily for Mr. Trump.
Mm-hmm.
The last one, the last race that cost more than $1 million, 85 Assembly District, Republican Representative Pat Snyder avenged his defeat in 2012. That race cost more than $1 million. What intrigues me is the candidates and their partisan committees, $514,000 out of $1 million. The rest of it came from outside groups.
Well, that's one where
American Federation for Children
went in. That was a race that in late summer we're talking about how Manuel Wright was in great position to win that seat. But American Federation went in and started hitting her hard, and Dems were slow to respond to it. It allowed the message to seep in and take hold that she had these issues, and they really pounded her hard, and he backed it by her. Now, that area of the state also went for Trump, so even if they had gotten in earlier, maybe it would have changed it, maybe not. But that's one of those ones where we all thought, okay, this calculation of what 16 should look like turned out to be very, very wrong.
What are your thoughts, now that we've seen some of the numbers from the first year of these new campaign finance laws? Look ahead on 2018. Sky's the limit?
It depends. Water's not a, or politics is, it's not a, money in politics is not a finite resource, or it's not an infinite resource. There's actually a limit to how much people will spend. But it's also like water. It finds where it needs to go to be effective. So what I'm watching for example, in the state Senate, the districts that are up next year are much better for Democrats on the numbers than what the ones were this past year. The issue is in off-year elections, the environment's been much better for Republicans the last few cycles. Now, how will President Trump be viewed a year and a half from now? That has a huge impact on these legislative races. If the mood is good for Democrats, they can be competitive against Howard Markline, maybe a Roger Roth, you know, some seats like that, Terry Moulton up in the Eau Claire area. If Donald Trump is doing well, then you might see an environment like what we saw in 14 and 10 where Republicans have a good year.
Do you see, though, the Democratic vacuum cleaner of the campaign of Senator Tammy Baldwin? Do you think she'll come in and get so much money at the expense of the Democratic candidate for governor?
Well, Baldwin's a little different. She has a bit of a national fundraising network, so it's not, we'll see. It's going to be, for Democrats nationally, part of the problem is, I think there are like two dozen seats to defend or something like that, 15 to 25. So they're on defense nationally. So there'll be a lot of national money going to the seats they have to try and take care of. Fascinating to watch how she does. She'd raised one and change last year, had $1 million in the bank to start this year. So she's a good fundraiser, has that national network. I think she's going to be okay money-wise. How will the GOP field develop? You know, Sean Duffy's not going to run. The rest of the folks who are looking at it don't have an infrastructure right now. They have to build one.
Yeah.
So it'll be fascinating to watch how that develops, but they also will work hand in hand. The Dems have the color coordinated campaign where everybody from the top down try to work together with these field offices and those kinds of things. Republicans also have their own operation that's quite good. They won a lot of elections, so it'll be fun to watch.
Okay, let's turn the corner and be done with campaign finance talk. Let's look ahead to what's up next week in the houses of the when the Senate and the Assembly meet. We're coming around a second round approval of the constitutional amendment to get rid of the state treasurer's office. Now, have you been to the office of the state treasurer? It is in the basement.
Yes.
It is one person, the state treasurer, and it's just amazing that an office that you and I remember when it had 8, 10, 12 people, they handled unclaimed property, and gradually over the years the duties have been grabbed.
You used to oversee the state's college EdVest program.
Yes. EdVest is gone. Unclaimed property is gone. Our state treasurer now is in the basement in an office that's not even a suite. Okay, so when's the last time, though, that we abolished a constitutional officer?
I don't think we have yet.
Okay.
So.
That's That's interesting.
So this amendment cleared both committees this week.
Yeah.
It's up before both houses next week. The vote's a formality on the floor of the Assembly and the Senate. The question is, okay, once it clears, it goes to a statewide referendum in April of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
The questions I have are, one, will anybody, any group, anything spend money next spring to either try and kill the Treasurer's Office or try to protect the Treasurer's Office? Who gets excited about this? Now,
no.
You can make arguments on both sides about whether to keep it or get rid of it, but
pundits like us, nobody. Go ahead.
How will the public be educated about this office? Will they care? That's one big question I have. And then two, you know, what's turnout going to be like next spring? We've got a contested Supreme Court race.
Yes.
We expect. Gableman's up for re-election, so that'll
right.
be interesting to watch. What the mood is like, what the environment is like, all kinds of stuff like that. But next week is just kind of like checking off a box and going toward that referendum. If it's approved, come January of 19, there's no more state treasurer.
There's no more state treasurer.
And Doug LaFollette should get nervous after that.
Well, he's down, I think, two employees. But I looked it up. In the governor's budget in brief, if it's budgeted at $113,500, so if that's gone, that's all you're going to save, which is basically one person's salary and fringe benefits.
Yeah, but, I mean, Doug LaFollette, Secretary of State, I mean, that office used to oversee elections like 40-some years ago.
Yes.
That was taken away and the old Elections Ethics Board were created. And then you saw, like, and you've seen a gradual erosion, and it's not just, like, Republicans. Tommy Thompson did it. Governor Jim Doyle did it. Scott Walker's in it, where they've been pulling these responsibilities away from these offices and pulling them where? In DOA, under, like, their control. It's just been going on for a long time. Or, you know, now the Elections Ethics Board to then the GAB, now back to the Elections Commission. I mean, they're taking them away and putting them elsewhere.
And there's a legislator that wants to do away with another constitutional officer, the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
That's going to be a tougher one.
Really, that's true, because the Supreme Court just reaffirmed that the rules developed by DPI are not subject to the governor's.
Yeah, but if they want to do an amendment to get rid of the DPI superintendent, it's a tougher decision, a tougher argument to make for what I've been told to people of, we should take the head of education and get rid of that person and give it to blank. So that's a little bit tougher to make. I mean, also, like, the treasurer, ask anybody in the street, even the Capitol Square.
Right.
What does a treasurer do? You get a lot of blank stares.
Right. And for those of you that haven't been in the Capitol, it's very interesting. In the basement, there's a door that leads to the state treasurer's office. One person next to him is the Secretary of State. And I think it's Mr. LaFollette plus maybe one or two assistants.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I'm kind of intrigued. Next week in the Assembly, the Right to Try bill is up. If you are terminally ill, the Right to Try bill... It says you can experiment, you can be administered, you can take something that has not yet been approved by the FDA if all other treatment options have been considered, if you have the recommendation or a prescription from the medical professional treating you, if you give written informed consent, and it also includes a liability from manufacturer or someone treating that person. This is just an interesting concept. Many other states have it, I think.
Yeah, it's an emotional issue. The medical side is not a big fan of this bill. They've got a number of issues with it. But in the testimony that we've heard from committees, it's emotional. People who are looking for something to hold on to kind of at the end of life, they don't have their options. They're going to try anything they can. They stay on this earth. So this gives them the option. Governor Walker indicated an openness to it. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is pushing a federal version of this bill. He's been a big proponent of this. So I get the impression it's doing all right. We'll see how it does in the Senate. I believe it goes to the Assembly first.
I think so.
It's up next week.
Yeah.
How it does in the Senate. But there is some passion behind it. And Representative Jimmy Boy Edming last week, I think, when the hearing said, you know, look, the next step for these folks is obituary page. You know, give them this kind of this option, you know, and kind of what's it hurt kind of thing.
Okay. Anything I've forgotten in terms of what's up next week? Is the Senate going to get this bill that says if you're at Lincoln Hills and you witness?
Yes. Mandatory reporting bill for
mandatory
child
reporting.
Abuse. For correctional officers, that is up. We've got Right to Try in the Assembly. We've got the constitutional amendment and that bill in the Senate.
Okay.
A couple of big ones.
All right. Let's make the swing stock report.
So Jason Ray, probably don't know who he is, but he is now your Secretary of the National Democratic Party. So 2 years ago, Jason Ray, who's a political operative in Milwaukee, lost a race for State Democratic Party chair.
Finished second to Martha Lanning, right?
Because he was seen as being too much of an insider, kind of professional political class. He then, two years later, wins a race for the National Party Secretary's Office by wooing the exact people, like the exclusive club of the DNC.
Yes.
Ray, interesting story. At 17, was elected to the DNC, youngest person ever elected to the National
He's
Party.
He's now 31, I think.
30?
30.
This was going to be his last term as a DNC member. He won re-election last summer at state convention, the DNC ran for this. This is not a campaign where you are doing mail or TV ads. This is shoe leather campaigning, where you're calling. There are 447, I think, members of the DNC. He told me he made 1,700 phone calls, calling these guys over and over, trying to connect with them. And he won. He led on all three ballots, I believe, and beat the incumbent, who was the former Baltimore mayor, former Baltimore mayor on the third ballot to win. And now he's got a seat at the table for the next 4 years. So, you know, good for him. A nice rise for
Jason. Is he so nationally focused that you do not expect him to again challenge Martha Lanning for state chair?
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen. Martha Lanning has got a challenge from Brian Kennedy, who was a former AFT head. So that's the race we're watching right now. I've not heard anybody else lately talking about that race, but we're expecting that matchup at the June convention.
June convention. Okay, next.
So you have a tuition cut. We've talked about this before, right?
5% tuition cut recommended by the governor. Resident undergrad tuition cut wouldn't start until the 2018-2019 school year.
So freeze it, then cut it 5%.
Yes.
And there's a pot of $35 million just sitting there to cut it, to pay for the cut. We've talked about this. Most people I talk to the Capitol do not think that $35 million is going to survive the budget process because it's just too much easy pickings. But this week, something interesting happened. Dale Kayenga, of the Joint Finance Committee, wrote a column basically saying we should allow tuition to go up by CPI.
Yes.
You know, some measure, something that we would limit it going forward, because the argument is at some point tuition has to go up. You can't freeze it forever. So how do you do it? Governor Walker had his own op-ed piece saying, no, kids deserve a break. You know, they need this 5% cut. What I'm getting the feeling from people is that the Finance Committee is not going to go along with the 5% cut, at least not paying for it. Maybe they'll cut a little bit or they'll move some money around, but the full 5% cut and $35 million for it is not going to happen. The question becomes, what do you do? Do you freeze it the first year and then tell, okay, Regents, we give you back the power to dictate tuition, because they basically took that power away from the Regents for the past 5 years. At some point when it goes up, who do you want to blame? If you're a lawmaker, do you want parents to call you because you raised tuition, or call the Regents because they raised tuition? So there's this dance going on of what do we do next, because some point down the line, someday, they will have to pay more for tuition.
And just a P.S., didn't Speaker Voss float the idea of let's boost aids and grants to the most needy?
Robin Voss has poo-pooed the idea of a tuition cut from day one, pretty much. So.
And he was the first student regent back when.
Yes, he was.
Okay, falling.
So this week, DOT quietly nixed this environmental impact study of expanding the 39-994 corridor. So this runs from basically Madison to the Dells.
To the Dells.
So it was, they don't really tell us a whole lot about why, but it's because of rearranging priorities. Well, this is all about transportation revenues. So if you look at this project, you know, like DOT does, they put a lot of options on the table. One of them was to build a parallel highway to 9094.
Which got Representative Rip excited.
Never going to happen. Never spend that money for that. But they're looking at options. So one of the arguments was, look, why spend this money? We're not going to do this anytime soon. More than likely, at some point, either they'll rehabilitate the interstate as it is or add a lane. Like, let's be honest about this. And the money's not there right now. They've got other priorities ahead of that. Well, the transportation advocates are saying, wait, we see politics at play. I know you'll be shocked at this, Steve, but there are politics at play. That this is part of the Walker administration saying, okay, we have this much money. We have to prioritize. This is not a priority right now. Now, Tommy Deal, who owns the Tommy Bartlett Water Show,
yes,
up in the Dells, also head of the Tourism Association in Wisconsin, slams this. We need capacity up here. It's congested going from Madison to the Dells. Anybody who's driven home on a Sunday afternoon in July from up north down to the Illinois state line can tell you it is backed up quite a bit because of people going home. They want the capacity to bring more people in, and if they drive up every weekend and get stuck in traffic, they're not going to come back anymore. But what do you do?
And it takes decades to both design environmental impact and get and lay that wider concrete. Okay, we only got a few seconds.
Okay.
As we speak, Vice President Pence is with Mr. Ryan and I think the Health and Human Service Secretary and probably Senator Johnson in Janesville. This is a very controlled environment.
Yeah.
By invitation only. Is it invitation only so that the Speaker Ryan doesn't have to confront tough questions, as we've seen when members of his caucus have gone home for some of these town
meetings? Well, there are protesters outside, but most of these stops are coordinated, or they're choreographed to keep a tight message. They want to focus on repeal and replace Obamacare and keep it at that.
Yeah, I agree. Steve Walders.
I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for March 3.
Rewind, Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.